Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, historic talks are set between India and Pakistan.
In Afghanistan, a bicycle bomb kills mostly children. Is it a sign of Taliban strength or desperation?
Also, false rumors of rape in Iraq inflame Turkey.
Nice little old farmer ladies eating lamb kebabs in very modest restaurants wag their finger at you and talk about how angry they are that the American soldiers are raping the women in Iraq.
And they're called memory glasses.
Let's assume that you're wearing this device and it knows your itinerary, knows who you're going to be talking to. At some appropriate point before the meeting, it would start cueing you.
These stories coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Former New Jersey Senator Bill Bradley has endorsed Howard Dean for the Democratic presidential nomination. Bradley unsuccessfully sought the party's nomination in the 2000 election. He appeared with Dean and his supporters earlier today in Manchester, New Hampshire. Bradley said his endorsement is an answer to fellow Democrats.
Many of them have asked me who among this very capable group of candidates I would recommend. My answer is Howard Dean.
Retired General Wesley Clark and Senator John Kerry, both of whom are competing with Dean for the party's presidential nomination, downplayed Bradley's endorsement today. Dean also has the backing of former Democratic Vice President Al Gore. India and Pakistan have announced they'll hold peace talks starting next month. The logistics of the talks have yet to be worked out. In a statement, the foreign ministers of both countries said all issues will be discussed, including disputes over the region of Kashmir. Afterwards, Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf described the breakthrough as a victory for the peace-loving people of the world.
We will move forward with hard work, with sincerity, and with trust in each other. Pakistan will play its role effectively in its desire and sincerity to move forward.
A U.S. delegation flew to North Korea today, hoping to visit a nuclear complex at the center of the country's atomic arms program. NPR's Rob Gifford reports from Beijing.
The Bush administration has said the group is not visiting North Korea on behalf of the U.S. government, and it has not been confirmed that the visitors will get to tour the nuclear facility at Yongbyon, north of the capital Pyongyang. If they do, however, it will be the first time outsiders have been allowed into the plant since UN inspectors were expelled more than a year ago. The group consists of a Stanford University scholar, two Senate aides, a former State Department official, and the former head of the Los Alamos National Lab. The visit comes as the other regional powers in Northeast Asia continue their efforts to start a second round of six-party talks with North Korea to follow the inconclusive round held in China last August. Rob Gifford, NPR News, Beijing.
Officials with a Mega Millions lottery say an Ohio woman has stepped forward with a winning ticket for the $162 million jackpot. Rebecca Jemison of South Euclid turned in the winning ticket, but she's not the woman who filed a police report last week saying she lost the ticket. Police said that story was credible, but the Ohio lottery says whoever turns in the valid ticket is legally entitled to the winnings. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 43 points at 10,500. The Nasdaq is up a fraction at 2,047. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the Federal Reserve reports consumer debt reached a record of nearly $2 trillion last October. The debt load includes car loans and credit cards, but not mortgages. The average debt per household is just under $19,000. While Americans are increasing the amount of debt they carry, they're decreasing their savings. The government reports the savings rate has dropped to 2% of after-tax income. The jury selection process is underway in the New York City fraud trial of entrepreneur Martha Stewart. Carrie Nolan of member station WNYC reports.
Potential jurors will answer a written questionnaire developed by Stewart's defense team and approved by the presiding judge Miriam Goldman Cederbaum. Attorneys for both sides will see the answers tomorrow and have till January 12th to tell the judge which candidates they want removed for cause. Stewart is set to appear in court January 20th. She has pleaded not guilty to charges of making false statements about the sale of stock she held in biotech company ImClone. She also faces charges of securities fraud, conspiracy, and obstruction of justice. Prosecutors filed a new indictment yesterday against Stewart and her former stockbroker, Peter Bakanovic. It changes some language but does not add any new charges and is not expected to have any effect on the case. Both Stewart and Bakanovic are required to re-enter their pleas. For NPR News, I'm Carrie Nolan.
A job placement firm reports companies laid off fewer workers at the end of last year. Job placement firm Challenger, Gray & Christmas says job cuts were 16% less at the end of 2003 than at the end of 2002. The firm also says the rate of layoff announcements were 6.5% lower in December than they were in November. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
The NPR Shop features Driveway Moments, a CD compilation of public radio stories so compelling they won't let you go, at npr.org.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The leaders of India and Pakistan announced today that they will begin talks in 1 month to try to resolve the bitter issues that have divided the two nations and taken thousands of lives for years. The announcement came 1 day after an historic face-to-face meeting between Indian Prime Minister Atal Vajpayee and Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf. We're joined by New Delhi journalist Veer Singh on the line from India and by Adil Najam, a Pakistani-American professor of international affairs at Tufts University's Fletcher School here in Boston. And Veer, to you first in India. Pakistan and India have fought three major wars since the 1947 partition of the two countries. They've battled over the last decade over the territory of Kashmir. So what is your sense that these new talks will stick?
Well, this meeting between Mr. Vajpayee and Mr. Musharraf has taken place not very long after Indian and Pakistani forces almost went to war. Less than a year and a half ago. So there's tremendous hope that just the fact that these two leaders have met will push all of this a little bit forward. And, of course, there's also concern and more questions as to what specifically has Pakistan told India, if at all, about assurances on what it might do to curb terrorism in India.
Professor Najam in Boston, as a Pakistani-American, what are your thoughts? Do you have optimism, and then what are your concerns?
I am pathologically optimistic on this, if only for survival reasons. But even I am surprised by the level of optimism and hope I find in Pakistan right now. I was there a few weeks ago, but if you look at the Pakistani newspapers, something has changed, and I think something has changed drastically. There is immense hope. And I think what's happened is that this trickle, drip of track two, of public-to-public diplomacy, of people-to-people meeting, has created a sense of the possible, has created a sense of hope.
Veer Singh in India mentioned what the Pakistanis might have to promise. As a Pakistani-American, what do you need to hear from India?
I think what Pakistan would like to see from India and would need to see from India is de-escalation in Kashmir, a reduction of military presence in Kashmir, the normalization of ties, not just on Kashmir, but on economics, on sports, on people-to-people interaction, but a greater openness to talk to Pakistan as an equal partner.
Yeah. Veer Singh, in India, Kashmir is currently inhabited mostly by Muslims, as is Pakistan. What has to happen to resolve the conflict there, and briefly?
Well, we've seen the government send envoy after envoy coming back empty-handed. What is really needed is some sort of dialogue, not at the highest level, but some sort of attempt to really listen to the voices of the people of Kashmir. So there has to be more real participation by Kashmiris to see if they can operate within the framework of a greater India.
And Professor Najam, here in Boston, you mentioned that the leaders have to listen to the people. And I'm wondering, how about their own party or the military? And I guess that leads to a question that many are wondering, and it's a kind of a blunt one. Could this action, could these talks cost either man their life?
I don't think it can cost them their life. I mean, on the one hand, General Musharraf's life is already in danger, as we saw with various attacks earlier in the last few weeks, but not on this issue particularly. However, both the sides, General Musharraf and the Indian Prime Minister, are taking it a step further from their constituencies. They have a lot of negotiation to do at home. Mr. Vajpayee with his own party, General Musharraf with the military as well as the Islamic parties.
Mm-hmm. Gentlemen, I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Adil Najam, Professor of International Relations at Tufts University's Fletcher School, Veer Singh, a journalist who spoke to us from New Delhi, India.
8 children were among the 10 people killed today when a bicycle bomb exploded in Afghanistan. The bomb went off this morning in a street near a U.S. military base in the southern city of Kandahar. A man who fled the scene has been detained. Taliban, say Afghan officials. A Taliban spokesman denies it. The bomb comes just days after Afghans approved a new constitution, a document designed to usher in a new era of peace and democracy, a document that sets out, among other things, impressive rights for women. But what will it be for Afghanistan? Bombs or votes? Or both? Carlotta Gall of The New York Times joins us from Kabul. Welcome, Carlotta.
Hi, thank you.
Terrible incident in Kandahar. Is it a modus operandi that fits in with any particular group or faction? Was it the Taliban?
Yes, I think despite their denials, and one never quite knows who's doing the denying, I think this has the hallmarks of Taliban. And we've had several bomb blasts over the last few months, some sort of urban campaign.
Carlotta, is it quite clear that they were targeting civilians? Why would they do that, let alone children? Afghans, like people in so many places, but Afghans are known for their love for children.
That's certainly true, but I think the Taliban have turned very ruthless. They weren't having much success hitting Americans, so now they're trying to hit aid workers, and now these sort of bomb blasts in the streets, because they're soft targets, it frightens people, it deters reconstruction, it deters commerce, and all these things which they just don't want to see happening, because their whole policy, I think, is to show that the American-backed government of Hamid Karzai is not working.
Well, speaking of revival, let's talk for a moment about the new constitution approved by 502 delegates to that Loya Jirga, or Grand Council. It took 3 weeks, but it's an extraordinary document, sets up impressive rights, democratic standards, calls, for example, Carlotta, for 25% of the Afghan lower house to be women. Now, that would be more women percentage-wise than in the U.S. Congress. How did that happen, and is it for real?
Well, that one is for real, because they will be appointed. They don't have to be elected, so that quota is selected for the women. So it is pretty remarkable. I mean, I think what the Constitution shows was that despite the Taliban and despite the wars that did radicalize a lot of Islamic fighters, the Afghans actually are quite moderate as Muslims. They're very strong Muslims. They very fervently believe in their religion, but they're not extreme by nature. And so I think this is what came out over the debate. There was a lot of tough debate, and there were hardliners who wanted a lot of stronger Islamic strictures in and so on. But in the end, I think the document we got was enlightened and a sign of, I think, what the Afghans want.
Elections scheduled for June. Only 1% of Afghans registered in any way to vote. That June deadline for elections realistic in any way?
Very difficult, and already UN officials are saying going to slip back. But I think Hamid Karzai is determined not to stay in his position without the legitimacy of elections. So I think they'll get presidential elections by the fall, though.
Carlotta, despite this bicycle bomb in Kandahar and the stream of violent incidents in Kandahar and throughout the country's south, do you remain optimistic about this country's future?
I do, and I think anyone who's watched it over the last 20 years of terrible war These last 2 years have been a fantastic relief and revival for most Afghans. There's still a lot of problems. There's still some violence, there's insecurity, but they don't have an all-out war or a front line anymore, and that is a source of confidence for everyone.
Carlotta Gall is a reporter with the New York Times in Kabul. Carlotta, as always, thanks so much.
Thank you.
As proof that we live in a global village, a California sex therapist's comments about the metaphorical rape of Iraq have made their way to Turkey, and the consequences have been deadly. Rumors are running rampant in Turkey that American soldiers have raped thousands of Iraqi women, up to 4,000 according to Turkey's Islamist press. The U.S. Embassy in Ankara is calling the reports outrageous and irresponsible, and they appear to be a misinterpretation of an online commentary by a U.S. sex therapist who said the war is, in a sense, a rape of Iraq. With us on the line is the reporter who broke the story, Charles Radin, foreign correspondent for the Boston Globe. Hi, Charles.
Hi, Ira.
Well, to drive home just how deadly some people feel these rumors are, you report that the family of the suicide bomber who attacked the British bank, killing himself and others last month, the family believes he was incensed by these rumors of rape.
That's right. And this was a guy who did not at all fit anyone's profile of a suicide bomber. He was a grandfather and a father with a prosperous business and a pension, and he really went off about this idea that the Americans were raping everything in sight.
How prevalent are these rumors?
Oh, they're everywhere. I just finished a trip into the interior of Turkey, and, you know, nice little old farmer ladies eating lamb kebabs in very modest restaurants wag their finger at you and talk about how angry they are that the American soldiers are raping the women in Iraq.
In fact, the initial reports in the Turkish press were, as you write, published in Yeni Safak. It's the leading Islamist paper there, and they attribute this charge to a Dr. Susan Block, who is an online sex therapist. We've gone to her website here in the States, and she talks about everything from sex toys to politics. And she's written a column about the metaphorical rape of Iraq.
Right, and is, I must tell you, a very intelligent-sounding woman. And she was flabbergasted when I called her up and told her that there were these stories and that the embassy had put out a condemnation of what she had written. So you have this thing where any, I think, American looking at it would understand that there's nothing in what she wrote that said the American boys went out and raped Iraqi girls. She's right that it's clearly a metaphor. On the other hand, her prose, as I'm sure you saw, is florid. Mm-hmm. She doesn't just make the metaphor. She makes it and remakes it with allusions to violations of organs and things like this. Mm-hmm. And the Islamist press, give them a hook to hang something on, and they'll hang everything in sight on it, and that's what happens.
The hook, as you said, is her column. And by the way, we found it on the online political newsletter Counterpunch. It's run by Alexander Coburn, and it's called Smile and Enjoy It, The Rape of Iraq by Dr. Susan Block. And yes,
right,
it's clearly metaphor. Well, there was a second report in that same newspaper in Turkey claiming that Iraqi rioters who were killed in a town in Iraq last month were killed because they were protesting rapes of 30 young girls there by U.S. soldiers. I know, Charlie, you made a trip to Iraq, and others have reported that there were no reports of rapes there. What, if anything, is the Turkish government doing to get rid of these rumors?
The Turkish government is putting its head as deeply in the sand as it can get it. They won't even refer to Islamic extremists committing terror acts. Mm. When you go on the streets in Baghdad and other cities in Iraq, there is so much less fraternization than we saw in Vietnam or Cambodia or anywhere. This has been a fact of war since time immemorial. But the idea that there's any substantial number much less a massive number, I think is really implausible.
Charles Radin, thank you.
My pleasure. Good talking with you, Robin.
Charles Radin, foreign correspondent for the Boston Globe.
Just ahead, forgot your glasses. Well, how about glasses that make you less forgetful?
And later, a college professor's life in two genders.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
If you're forgetful at all, you may have tried ways to remember things, like that tried and true string around the finger. Though, of course, for some of us, that may mean a moment when you look at the string on your finger and try to remember what it's doing there. Well, a new higher-tech way to ignite your memory may be a new device called memory glasses. They were developed at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Media Lab. Joining us in the studio are two developers of the glasses, Dr. Sandy Pentland and PhD candidate Rich Duvall. Let's start with Dr. Pentland. What exactly are memory glasses?
The idea is to jog your brains, basically.
Well, do they vibrate or lights go off or what?
Little electrons go in and make it. No, the idea is subliminal cueing. And you probably have heard this for 1950s movies where they were supposed to flash Coke and everyone would get up and buy Coca-Cola.
Right.
Of course, that never worked. Never worked at all. But if you were just at the point that you were about to get up and go out and buy something to drink and they flashed Coke, you might actually buy Coke more often.
I see.
So something if it's right on the tip of your tongue or the sort of the surface of your brain, almost conscious, then that subliminal stuff, stuff you're not even aware of, can change what you remember and how you behave.
I see, Rich. So you're sitting, it's late in the morning, and you have a luncheon appointment, which maybe has gone completely out of your head. How would the glasses enable you to remember that you have to sit down with that guy at lunch?
When you're trying to support somebody's memory, it's really important to know what it is they're trying to remember. So part of the problem, of course, is knowing that you have that appointment scheduled. And the other part of the problem is then delivering the information to the person so they can get there. And our research has focused on using a subliminal cue. So let's assume that you're wearing this device and it knows your itinerary, knows who you're going to be talking to. At some appropriate point before the meeting, it would start cueing you, maybe about once a second. There would be a very, very short duration video frame on this display you're wearing, so short that you're not even aware that it's there.
Huh.
But the recent study that I conducted shows that this improves the chance of you correctly remembering material, at least you're trying to remember, by a factor of about 1.5 times.
There's a little window inside the glasses that you've got on?
That's exactly right.
And there's an image that comes up on it.
Well, there's an image, but it's strangely enough, this is an image that you can't consciously see. It's very short duration, and also we throw in some masking so that even if you're looking right at it and you're focusing on it, you can't actually read it or can't actually see it.
So, Sandy, if you were trying to remember a luncheon appointment with a certain person, what would the image be?
There's a number of ways to do it, but it could just say lunch appointment.
Okay.
Or if you had a picture of the person, you could have a little picture of the person. The point is it jogs that gray matter just enough to get it to come to the surface of your brain and you actually remember it.
So how does it store up inside the glasses? Suppose you've got a very full day and it's going to have to remind you of six things.
Well, it's just like your PDA or your computer or any of those other little electronic bits. Storing stuff is not a problem anymore.
Yeah.
As Rich was saying, the big thing is figuring out when it is you need to be reminded, when you need to be reminded to take your medicine or... But some of these things are pretty obvious. Like when you go out the door, you might need to be reminded to take your keys.
Would it be possible to sabotage someone's day, put in cues that were to do something
they shouldn't do? Or
so the whole Manchurian candidate,
yeah,
shoot the president scenario.
You got it.
No, absolutely not. That's the great thing because, you know, as our research has shown, misleading cues, incorrect cues simply get filtered out. We're constantly processing all kinds of information that we're not actually aware of. Most of this just gets filtered out before you even have a chance to pay attention to it. And when the cue is incorrect, it gets filtered out just like everything else. But if you're trying to remember something, if it's on the tip of your tongue, the cue helps sort of push it over.
Now, Sandy, how far away are we from being able to go buy a pair of these things?
If you had something that was a very important application, I like to talk about, say, operator of a nuclear power plant or a doctor in surgery, where you could afford to spend a lot of money because it's really important that they do it right, we could probably begin doing that pretty quickly, say, within a year or so. As for something that your great aunt can use, that's going to take a little bit longer. The other thing that we're looking at is being able to do it with audio rather than visual, so it whispers in your ear. But again, it whispers it at a time and at a volume where it's not something that you actually are consciously aware of. It gets into your brain, but you don't know that it's happened. And something like that could make use of existing hearing aids and an existing telephone or PDA. So the hardware might not actually cost anything at all. It might just be a bit of software.
A lot of people out there, from heads of corporations to moms trying to raise a couple of kids, that would be very gratified to have a way to get nudged into being where they're supposed to be at a given moment without,
And also police, firefighters, first responders. It turns out firefighters have to have a huge amount of information in their head because they respond to all kinds of emergencies. Emergency room physicians, you know, a trauma patient comes in, they have to know what to do next. And these are all people who work in complicated environments. They have to make effective decisions very quickly. So being able to support their memory effectively without distracting them could be a really important thing.
One of the applications that I think may turn out to be almost the most important is elder care.
Yeah.
As you get older, your memory begins to go. Various other things happen. And if you can remind people to take their medicine, remind people the names of the people around them, remind them to take their keys, they can stay healthier, they can stay in their home, and they can stay more socially integrated far longer. And with the sort of rise of aging population, this is a really critical issue.
Of course, you got to wear glasses.
Or a hearing aid.
Yeah, we're trying to move away from it just being something integrated into glasses.
Dr. Sandy Pentland, thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
And PhD candidate Rich Duvall, thank you very much.
Thanks for having us here.
Both Dr. Sandy Pentland and Rich Duvall are at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Media Lab.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, the Wall Street Journal, it isn't all about bulls and bears. We'll talk to the front page editor about some of the other favorite animal stories featured in the famous middle column.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, Catholic bishops release a report on how the country's parishes are complying with rules on preventing clergy sex abuse.
Democratic candidates for president debate again. This time, they can't play to the cameras.
And transgendered author Jenny Finney Boylan about her book, She's Not There.
Ultimately, this book is not about how to have a sex change. It's about the question that everybody asks, which is, how do I learn to find the courage to become myself.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. Howard Dean's Democratic presidential candidacy continues to pick up steam. Today, former Senator Bill Bradley, who ran for the Democrats' nomination in 2000, endorsed Dean in New Hampshire. Bradley declared the former Vermont governor one of the best things to happen in American democracy in decades, while blasting the policies of President Bush.
You have to be blunt and relentless in telling the truth about what he has done. He shifted the tax burden down onto the middle class. He's turned the federal budget into a feeding trough of special interests. He's raped the land and ignored the poor.
Bradley also says Dean is in a position to beat President Bush because the Dean campaign represents what he calls positive patriotism. The Roman Catholic Church says its recently adopted policy to prevent sex abuse by priest is working. However, advocates for victims are not buying it. An audit commissioned by church leaders says nearly all 90% of the nation's Roman Catholic bishops are following through with the mandatory policy, which dictates how to punish offending priests and how to protect children. The review, which was done by a private firm in Boston, was commissioned by the bishops. 20 dioceses are listed as not fully in compliance, among them the Archdiocese of New York. In Afghanistan, a bomb attached to a bicycle killed at least 10 people, most of them children, on a road usually used by U.S. troops in the southern city of Kandahar today. Up to 58 people were wounded. Afghan police say the bombing is the work of the Taliban. One of the nations that most adamantly opposed invading Iraq now says it has lost two citizens there. France says two French citizens were killed and another injured by gunfire last night. They'd been working for an American company and were traveling near the tense city of Fallujah. India and Pakistan today took a giant step towards putting more than a half century of bloodshed behind them. They agreed to start talks next month on core disputes of nationalism and religion that have taken the nuclear-armed neighbors into three wars. Britain's royal coroner briefly opened, then adjourned, the first formal British inquest into the deaths of Princess Diana and Dodi Fayed. The coroner says it will likely reopen early next year. The coroner, he says, he asked London police to investigate conspiracy theories surrounding the deaths and whether they should be a part of the case. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are mixed. The Dow is down 41 points.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The country's Catholic bishops say measures they've taken to prevent sexual abuse by priests have been largely successful. An audit released today by the Conference of Catholic Bishops finds that 90% of the country's 195 dioceses are in full compliance with new reforms adopted in June of 2002. Here's Bishop Wilton Gregory speaking this morning.
The audit results represent solid progress on the journey toward fulfilling the vision set out in the Charter. I believe that these findings show that we bishops are keeping our word.
Suzanne Morse is a spokesperson for the lay Catholic group Voice of the Faithful. She joins us now from Boston. Welcome, Suzanne.
Thank you.
Well, Suzanne, just boil it down for us, if you would. What does the report say, and what do you think of what it says?
The report basically says that the dioceses are in compliance with the revised norms that the bishops passed in 2002.
Do you buy it?
We buy that they're in compliance with these revised norms.
Mm-hmm.
We had some concerns about the norms when they passed. And we still have those concerns. In particular, it is concerning to us that the audit measured the existence of these policies, not really the effectiveness of them. They backed off a little bit from the zero tolerance policy. The specific provisions were not as complete as we would have liked, you know, and they were not as complete in involving the survivor community and the lay community as we would have liked.
Now, the audits were carried out primarily by former FBI agents and investigators.
Mm-hmm.
They traveled around the country interviewing priests and bishops and victims and lay people. Some victims groups are saying, Suzanne, as I'm sure you know, that the report is meaningless because it was largely influenced by the very bishops who commissioned it. In other words, they were sort of examining
right.
themselves and predisposed to come out with a good result. What do you think of that?
We don't think that it is a meaningless report. At the very least, it is giving us some data,
mm-hmm.
and that's a good first step.
There's another report due out February 27th. What's that about?
As far as we know, that report is about the causes of the crisis.
Voice of the Faithful has become such an important movement within the Catholic Church, and often at odds with the more sort of bureaucratic levels of the Archdiocese of Boston and other places. How are you feeling about reform in the Catholic Church at this point, and how are your relations with the church hierarchy?
Well, I think we're feeling positive about reform in the Catholic Church
mm-hmm.
right now. I mean, I think the fact that the bishops are holding themselves publicly accountable and that there are recommendations within the report for further public accountability from the bishops is a positive step. It's almost a revolutionary step. And so that makes us feel very positive about the chances of reform in the Catholic Church. But we are very cognizant of the fact that it is only a first step, and it is a long, long process that we all need to be a part of in order to heal this church.
Suzanne, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Suzanne Morse is a spokesperson for Voice of the Faithful. She joined us from Boston, Massachusetts.
Today in Manchester, New Hampshire, Democratic frontrunner Howard Dean received the endorsement of former senator and former presidential candidate Bill Bradley.
With the help of the American people, under the leadership of Howard Dean, we have the power to take our country back from George Bush and his radical friends and to return our government to the side of moderation and to the rightful role as a partner for building peace in the world.
Bradley's endorsement comes on the day of the only radio debate the Democratic candidates will take part in. Six of the nine Democratic candidates are scheduled to attend today's NPR-hosted debate in Des Moines, Iowa. And joining us on the line for a debate preview is Ken Rudin, political editor for National Public Radio. He's in Washington, D.C. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Robin.
Well, what's going to be different about this afternoon's debate? I mean, there have been so many so far. What can happen differently?
Well, what's different, of course, is that a lot of times people, professional politician watchers who watch these debates will always look for the gap or even the facial gap. We always remember the first President Bush checking his watch during the 1992 debate. We remember Al Gore rolling his eyes during the 2000 debate. This one will be very substantial, very much on the issues, far less on personality. I think personality is important. I think it plays an important part. But this debate will be different. It will not be on facial expressions. It will not be hogging camera time. It will be on the issues.
Well, as a matter of fact, there will not be any television cameras allowed.
No television cameras and no audience, so there will be no candidate who will try to get some zinger in to get a reaction from the audience.
But still, I know it's going to be moderated by Talk of the Nation's Neil Conan, but what can be asked that hasn't been asked and avoided?
Well, avoided is one thing. A lot of, as we've seen with all these debates, and there have been more debates this cycle than any other in presidential history, there are some questions that, believe it or not, that have never been asked.
Such as?
Well, for example, this one of the questions to Governor Dean, we're going to talk about the war on poverty. And, you know, since 1965, since Lyndon Johnson declared the war on poverty, we've had Democratic presidents, Republican presidents, Democratic and Republican Congresses, and yet the war has not been won. Why? If you are, another question, if you're going to be on the Supreme, who would you pick? Who is on your list of potential Supreme Court justices? Those questions have not been asked. A lot of them have been on kind of simplistic gaffe questions about, well, why did you say this, and why are you hiding your records? And it's really, it gets kind of like a food fight. This is to prevent the food fight.
Mm. How is both Bill Bradley's endorsement and what he said, specifically, you know, attacking George Bush, how's that going to play?
The criticism we heard about George Bush, President Bush, is not unique to what Bill Bradley had to say today. We've heard this criticism of Bush on the war, on the economy, on the state of national security, on homeland security, on protecting this country since 9/11. What's interesting about this endorsement is that Howard Dean, perhaps being a governor with no foreign policy experience, he has not served in the military, unlike Kerry and Clark. Howard Dean probably needs the foreign policy and national security bona fides, and it's very possible that Bill Bradley, having served in the Senate for 18 years and having been widely respected in this field, can bring that for him.
Yeah. One last question. Former President Bill Clinton has not endorsed anyone. Do you think he might?
Well, he said he won't, and I take him at his word. I think he said that he's there for anybody who needs his help, and of course we'll rally around whoever the nominee will be. I think the real endorsement that everybody's looking at so much is not so much Bill Clinton, but Tom Harkin, the senior senator, the Democratic senator from Iowa. There's a rumor that he will make an endorsement this week, and you know there's a big ferocious fight for first place in Iowa between Howard Dean and Richard Gephardt, with John Edwards and John Kerry perhaps fighting for third place. A Harkin endorsement could be the thing that really makes a difference this year, if an endorsement does matter at all.
Mm. Well, Ken, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Robin.
Ken Rudin, political editor for National Public Radio. For more information on today's live radio debate or to take the candidate quiz to find out if one may be right for you, go to our website, here-now.org.
Still to come, James Boylan is now Jenny Finney Boylan. We'll speak to Professor Boylan about her new book about becoming a woman.
You're listening to Here and Now. The annual Detroit Auto Show got underway last night, and the big U.S. three, General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler, are hoping to take back some of the road from foreign, mostly Japanese, automakers. Mark Gillies is executive editor of Automobile Magazine. He joins us now on the line from the show in Detroit. Welcome, Mark.
Good afternoon. Hi, how are you doing?
Good. And I know that Ford in particular is calling 2004 the year of the car. What's the big deal about the passenger car this year?
Well, the big deal is that Detroit's been making a lot of its money from sport utilities and trucks, and now the Japanese are going after that market. The big three are feeling that they have to get back into passenger cars.
They have a ways to go, though, because don't most Americans now perceive foreign, especially Japanese-made passenger cars as better quality than American cars?
I think that's very much the case, and I think it's a perception that's happened over the past 20, 25 years. It's been a long time happening, and of course, you know, people have been buying American cars because they've got a good deal on them and because they're cheap rather than because they're good. And so I think, you know, General Motors and Ford and Chrysler have got a long way to go to recapture the ground that they used to have in the past when they were utterly dominant in passenger cars.
What are some of the things that they're doing and that you can see at the auto show to win over the American public?
Chrysler, for instance, is building a rear-wheel drive car that uses some Mercedes componentry. And it's big, and it looks very different to the regular passenger sedan. So they're going an alternative route, hoping that that's going to get people excited and back into American cars. General Motors is actually doing some cars that are very clonish of Japanese cars, with a little bit of European sort of sporty driving style. Well, that's what they're telling us, but we haven't driven that many of the cars yet. And Ford is really doing, I think, very safe, predictable cars, but that may actually be what the market wants.
We know that as inconceivable as it sounds, the U.S. automakers have been adopting manufacturing systems that were developed in Japan, for instance. But they're also the old is also new again because they're bringing out new versions of the Mustang and the Corvette.
The Mustang is interesting because it looks like an old Mustang. It's very what we call retro. The design looks like an old car. And, you know, there's some talk at the show that Ford's losing its way on design direction because they're just sort of copying old cars rather than looking forward and producing exciting-looking new cars for the future.
Well, Mark, we know that the Japanese market is planning a counterassault. They're even, as you alluded to, bringing out their own pickup, heaven forbid. But how important is this year in cars? Is there a sense that, you know, maybe even one of the big car makers might not make it?
There's a sense that Ford is in real trouble. I mean, Ford of Europe is bleeding money big time. Ford in America is doing very well with the F-150 pickup truck, but there is a sense that Ford is bleeding at the moment, particularly because General Motors is mounting a sales assault using incentives, which is really undermining Ford. I'm not sure it will go under Ford, but they're in real trouble, and I think Daimler Chrysler as well has got some problems because without the very, very deep pockets of Daimler-Benz, the Chrysler operation would be in dire trouble.
Do you think the car makers are going to get U.S. auto buyers out of SUVs and into cars?
I don't think they're going to be getting buyers out of SUVs and into cars, per se. I think they want to get people out of Japanese cars and into American cars. If you look, one of the most interesting cars at the show is the Ford Freestyle, which looks like a truck and it's built on a car platform. It's one of this increasing trend of crossovers. And I think you're going to see more and more customers going into those crossovers.
Right. Well, Mark, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mark Gillies, executive editor of Automobile Magazine. He spoke to us from the North American International Auto Show in Detroit.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Colby English professor James Boylan was a successful teacher and author with a wife and two children he adored. The one problem? Boylan felt that he was actually a she. And so, with the love of his family and despite the struggles of his wife Grace, who lost so much while he gained so much, James Boylan became Jenny Finney Boylan. That journey is chronicled in Jenny's new book. It's titled She's Not There, A Life in Two Genders. And Jenny Finney Boylan, the woman, joins us in the studio. A beautiful woman, by the way.
Oh, get out of here.
Okay.
Look who's talking. It's radio, so they have to take your
word
for that.
They have to believe me.
Thank you.
But the woman who was always inside you, I was astonished to read, even when you were 3 years old.
Yeah, and in fact, that's not atypical for transgendered people, that you have a sense of something being wrong, just about your earliest memory.
In your case, it was you sitting there watching your mother iron.
Yeah, she was ironing shirts, and she said, "Someday you'll wear shirts just like your father's." And I thought, well, why?
Because you thought, I'll wear shirts like my mom.
That's right.
At three. And then as you grew up, it was something that you had an inner dialogue with yourself about these ideas. Oh, stop it. But there's a point where you share in the book where you actually used to go play a game in the woods called Girl Planet, which you are an astronaut who crashes in a world where you can become a girl. Would you mind reading for us? It's in the segment of the book early on, right after you've described this playing in the woods and people coming to say, we're looking for James Finney Boylan, the novelist. We found his rocket all smashed up in the woods. And you reply, oh, I'm sorry, he's gone now.
I did not know the word transsexual back then, and the word transgendered had not yet been invented. I'd heard the word transvestite, of course, but it didn't seem to apply to me. It sounded kind of creepy, like some kind of centipede or grub. In my mind, I sometimes confused it with the words that described cave formations. What was it again? Transvestites grew down from the top of the cave. Transvestmites grow up from the bottom. I'm just going to skip ahead a little bit for the sake of time. Mm-hmm. Gender is many things, but one thing it is certainly not is a hobby. Being female is not something you do because it's clever or postmodern or because you're a deluded, deranged narcissist. In the end, what it is more than anything else is a fact. It's the dilemma of the transsexual, though, that it is a fact that cannot possibly be understood without imagination.
One of the people who had some trouble with that is your dear friend, it sounds like your best friend, Richard Russo, the author. You were both teachers at Colby, and he's, of course, the, you know, I think of him as the tough guy author of books like Nobody's Fool.
Right.
And he just really wrestles with the idea that this wasn't a choice that you made, like you just decided to do this.
I included the story of my friendship with Rick Russo in the book because I wanted for there to be a dissenting voice. I wanted to give the reader, who I most readers, I would presume, know very little about this topic, someone to speak for them and to give voice to all the reservations and confusions that people have. I didn't want to write a book that was self-congratulatory. Mm-hmm. And so in showing the ways in which Rick did come around in the end, I'm hoping that that can stand in for the ways that readers can come around too, because ultimately this book is not about how to have a sex change. It's about the question that everybody asks, which is, how do I live an authentic life? How do I learn to find the courage to become myself?
And along the way, you take readers through the many tough steps of being authentic, and one of them was sitting down at the kitchen table one night and saying to your then-wife, Grace, I got to tell you something.
That's
you
right.
Married her because you thought that love would make you change.
Yeah, I think that is something that is not the particular delusion of the transsexual. I think that's everyone. We all look to the people that we love to change us, to bring us out of ourselves. And when I fell in love with Grace, I really felt, wow, I'm cured. This thing that has always burdened me is gone. And yet, in the end, nothing is enough to cure you of something that is essentially a genetic condition. It's not about how much you are loved. It's not about how much you pray. And ultimately, is something that you simply have to accept.
How do you handle? I mean, you have two children who, by the way, I mean, there's a lot of hilarity in the book for something that's such an overwhelming topic. And you know, the first time your children see you in a dress, they're sort of like, "Oh yeah, what are your children?"
Well,
calling you now?
My children, in fact, were quite sanguine about the business because they were able to understand a basic fact that, in some ways, eluded many adults, that the person who had been their father was not going away, that their parent loved them. This was not something that they had caused. Mm. My children, in fact, were the ones who came up with a new name for me. My older son, Luke, one day said, "We can't call you Daddy if you're a girl. That's just too weird." And I said, "Well, what do you want to call me?" And he said, "Well, how about Maddie? Because that's like half Mommy and half Daddy. And also, I know someone named Maddie at school." And I said, "Okay, Maddie's a good name."
What do you call Grace?
We call her Mommy.
And how do you define your relationship now?
Well, our relationship is still in flux. We are people who share a family, who share a friendship, and we are people who love each other.
Yeah. How lucky for us, the reader, that you telling us this story are also a terrific writer. It just so happens. And so the stories are told in sort of an essay form, how you encounter former students. And I'm thinking of other moments where you can see a world that we will not see. For instance, you have gone into both men's rooms and bathrooms as each gender.
That's right. I mean, in a way, I think I'm very grateful that I was born transgendered, that there I mean, it was always a curse to me, but there is a way in which I see it as a great gift because I have gotten to see two sides of the world, and most people only get to see one.
Can you tell us, I mean, the bathroom is one thing where you discovered that, well, that's why the girls are sometimes in there so long. They're taking a break. They're sitting on a chair and getting away from the guys.
We're taking a few, having a few short moments away from you, darling.
I also loved how you described that as a male professor, it irritated you so when young women ended every sentence with a question mark, even when you asked them their name?
When I asked them, it was worse. I asked their names. Hello, my name's Jenny. Hello, my name's Robin. And just I remember when I was a guy, I would tell my students, do not say your name like it's a question. Your identity is not a question. Well, I found shortly after transition, I found that inflection sneaking into my own voice.
And oddly enough, you are finally who you've always known who you are, and you say your name with a question mark at the end because it's a woman's inflection.
I do if I don't think about it. Sometimes that happens.
Yeah.
But it is true. I do know who I am, and I feel so grateful now. I feel as if I had been in prison for 40 years for something that I didn't do, and then at the last minute, I got pardoned by the governor. And so each day, I walk around looking at the world, thinking, wow, I'm free.
Jennifer Finney Boylan, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Her book is called She's Not There. And by the way, the title? Is it the song?
It's three things. It's the song of the zombies, which kind of haunts me throughout the book. It's also all those years, the first half of my life, when people would see a man, even though I was female in spirit and I was not there. And towards the end of the book, it refers to the fact that what's lost is a marriage and a wife. So in the end, she who is not there is a wife. That's the loss, and that was the price that was paid.
The book is called She's Not There, A Life in Two Genders by Jenny Finney Boylan. For more information and for pictures, go to our website, here-now.org. Well, let me tell you about the way she looked, the way she had to have the color of her hair. Her voice was soft and cool, her eyes were clear and bright, but she's not there.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, Brad Fritz, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Thomas Terry and Matt Odette. Our web producer is Zach Christo.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again. Here and Now.
Please don't bother trying to find her. She's not there.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories Here and Now.
The Wall Street Journal isn't all about bulls and bears. We'll talk to the front page editor about some of the paper's other animal stories.
And singer Emmylou Harris.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.